Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Padre SJ joins us along with Emery Roan and me. We're going to talk about fan films' fate in honor of the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, the original series. We'll talk about No Mario's Sky, Game of Thrones world records, counter drones, and much more next on TWiL.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 359, recorded September 9th, 2016. My fridge is playing Tetris. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and I'm so excited you're joining us for this episode of This Week in Law, where we get together every week to talk about everything happening at the juncture of technology and the law. Great panel of folks joining me today. Here in the TWiT studio, our very own digital Jesuit, the Padre with the petabytes, Padre SJ, a.k.a. Father Robert Ballister. Hello. Great to see you again, Padre.
Thanks for having me back. I've never known myself as Padre with the petabytes, but I may have to start using that.
Yep. I'm giving it to you. Padre, of course, hosts TWiT and Know How here, right here on the TWiT network. And every now and then, very occasionally, but not frequently enough, comes and joins us here on TWiL to talk about stuff that has crossed his radar on the legal front. And of course, Padre flies every drone known to man, and we've been all about the drones lately. So I definitely thought this was a good opportunity to get him back on the show. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's always nice to have the crossover between our shows because we cover a lot of legal issues, and I can't tell you the number of times where I said, oh, I should have called Denise, but here we are. So this is the start of the crossover. Next, I have to have you back on TWiT.
I'd love to come whenever you'd like. And I'm sure Emery would like to be there too. Emery is one of my two lovely co-hosts. Emery Roan is a 3L now at California Western School of Law. Is that official yet, Emery?
That is official. I am in my third year. The end is in sight. It's so, so close.
So close. Yes. That third year of law school, that, you know, very good time. Still have to study, not as bad as one and two. He's obviously here with us, co-hosting the show. He's also an intern here at This Week in Law, an intern at New Media Rights. He has been an intern with the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, and he is just generally an up-and-coming great mind in all things related to internet law, cybersecurity, privacy, digital civil liberties, and more. We're just thrilled to have you with us, Emery, while
you
are doing so many other things as well.
That's very kind. Thanks, Denise. I'm super stoked to be here today. Very excited to have the cyber saint himself, the Padre with the petabytes in the black robe. Padre.
I'm not sure what's happening right now.
I saw it in the chat. I'm sorry, Samp. I had to steal that. That was wonderful. Anyways, let's get on with the show. This is great.
Let's get on with the show. I promise you we are going to talk about drones with Padre later in the show, but in honor of yesterday's momentous event, the 50th anniversary of the first airing of Star Trek, the original series. We're going to talk about some fan films and Star Trek, which we've done from time to time throughout this year, both because of the 50th anniversary and because there's been quite a bit happening there. So let's start there and let's talk about issues related to Hollywood music and entertainment. So I don't know if you guys can see, I am sporting my, here, I'll move it closer to the camera. No, I'm not doing that very well.
There we go.
I have my little Live Long and Prosper button that I've now turned upside down. This is a very precious thing to me. I got it as a child from something that was called the Federation Trading Post that existed in Berkeley, California. And it was this little fan-run store where you could go in and buy uniforms and things like buttons. And it was Mecca for me as a kid. I absolutely loved that place. Used to make my parents take me into Berkeley at the drop of a hat so that I could visit there. It has long since gone out of business, but I still have one of their buttons. And I'm afraid even all of that doesn't make me as big a fan of Star Trek as this gentleman, Mr. Colley. I forget exactly, blanking on his first name, but he is the gentleman who has decided to do the Star Trek New Voyages online series. And I was actually unfamiliar with the fact that that was out there and available, but it has been in production for a while. They have something like 11 episodes that are already out there. They've gotten Walter Koenig and James Doohan and George Takei to come, and lots of the former writers from Star Trek, the original series, to come and participate in their project. And I believe they have developed for their own series some scripts that never made it into production for various other Star Trek projects. So they have some they have a very respectful approach toward CBS and Paramount, and have sort of existed at the pleasure of the rights holders for some time. And seemed to me a little ticked off that Axanar came along, because Axanar brought a whole lot of attention to this full-length feature film that they are attempting to make with regular Hollywood production values, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the New Voyages folks would have rather that Axanar just let them, you know, hadn't existed. They would have continued to sort of fly under the radar, and maybe CBS and Paramount wouldn't have had to come out with their headlines. Now, not only don't let Axanar really proceed in its envisioned form, but also New Voyages is in trouble too. But what Mr. Colley has done to film New Voyages, he apparently was an intern at The Next Generation. And as he was finishing up his internship, and I'm afraid, Emery, I don't have anything this cool to pass along to you.
I was going to say, yeah, I need to go internship. At least make a visit to the studio.
Yeah,
see what
exactly.
I can grab at the last minute.
Whatever. Maybe someone will give you some interesting blueprints, because that's what happened to Mr. Colley. He was given blueprints to the original sets of the original series. And rather than just say, cool, I have these blueprints, he rented himself space in a former grocery store and started to build them out. And so we're seeing some footage from New Voyages. And if you just look at the sets, the detail of the sets, they just were incredibly faithful to how the original sets were built, the materials the original sets were built with. I remember reading at one place that they found out that so the carpeting used on the original sets was industrial grade carpeting used in car trunks. They went out and bought rolls of the stuff and used the same kind of carpeting. I mean, just incredible attention to detail. So this series has been out there. My son and I are excited to watch it now. And they have two additional episodes that are in production that they began before the new guidelines came out. And they're not, they don't have plans to release them until they have specific permission to do so. The other thing, they don't plan to make new episodes unless and until they're given permission to do that. What they have done, though, is turn their incredible playground of very faithfully reproduced sets into a tour that you can go to in New York and visit the place itself, buy tickets. And that is licensed from CBS and Paramount. They have been negotiating with them, at least on that front. And I'm sure they're in talks with them about what to do with the two unreleased episodes, et cetera. But it seems to me like they have pivoted away from, we're doing this online series, to we're going to work together to have an attraction that allows people to visit these sets.
And does it sound to anybody like they're actually going to get proper permission to release those last two episodes? Because from my read, Paramount is very politely saying, no, shut it down. And if you release anything else, we will go after you.
I don't know. I haven't seen the correspondence between the parties. I know that Mr. Colley and his group don't plan to test the legal waters. I don't think they want to be sued. I don't think they want to be in the position of arguing this is fair use and we're going to launch ahead and the elements we're using are not copyrightable. And, they're not taking the Axanar we'll fight this tooth and nail approach. It's worth revisiting what's going on with Axanar at this point, because we had some impression back in the May, June timeframe of this year that the suit against Axanar was going to get dropped. J.J. Abrams made statements in connection with the release of Star Trek Beyond that the studio was going to work with the fans and guidelines would be forthcoming. Well, the guidelines were forthcoming and they really don't allow for the making of a movie like Axanar. So as things stand, the lawsuit is still pending. The parties have answered each other's preliminary documents in the lawsuit, and that's still ongoing. So we'll just have to see what happens with New Voyages and if they do. I mean, the statements that I have read that they've put out have said that they expect that Axanar will have to wind its way through the courts and get resolved before they can have that conversation.
Right, because the very first guideline that was laid down was it can't be longer than 15 minutes for a self-contained story or a total of 30 minutes for a maximum of two segments, which already Axanar, it's not going to make the cut. I'd love to get your take on this, because if you look at the actual guidelines that Paramount released through their legal, it looks as if they're saying, look, we understand, we love our fans, their fans have sustained us even through the hard years. We know that there's been a long tradition of fan fiction, which is now making its way into video production, now that video production is actually affordable, and we want to continue that tradition. And then the next 10 things that they say, I don't know a single fan production out there that would meet the guidelines, because it's not only limited length. It's not only can you not pay your actors or any of your principals. It's also things like you cannot involve anybody who has ever had anything to do with a Star Trek property, which is basically, okay, yeah, you can do your thing, but no, you can't do your thing.
Yes, it's almost like they're trying their hardest to make sure that they have the same sort of protections in place that they would have without the guidelines, and yet use the guidelines to make
the New Voyager crew
PR.
Would sorry about that, Denise. I can't see the screen. I was just saying that, I think that Padre, you're absolutely right on the I want to say on the New Voyager's Facebook page, they said something to the effect of, first of all, you can tell that they obviously really value their relationship with CBS and have tried to be really respectful of it. And they're trying to say that on their Facebook page, they said, first of all, Paramount has not shut us down, but we are now just switching this to a, museum exhibit as opposed to continuing to make fan films, because we can't, we can't make fan films under the new guidelines. So, yeah, it is a real shame. It reminds me of, the when we were all hearing that, that CBS was going to encourage fan films, or that, the Axanar lawsuit was going away, I think was how it was, said earlier. That doesn't necessarily paint a good picture for the rest of the fan community or for the people that, want to make projects like this. It's no real surprise to me that we don't have firm guidelines, or we don't have a firm idea of what exactly is or is not permitted yet. I agree. I think that we're going to have to see how this winds its way through the courts before we have, a better idea of what exactly is allowed. And it's a shame, because I think that, personally, I think that the fan film community, there is an argument that it is fair use. I don't necessarily see that argument being successful in court. Right. So at least not in the current, waters So yeah, it's going to be very interesting to follow, and very disappointing if projects like these are, you know, chilled, because I didn't know about this. I would I'm going to spend some of my weekend going back over their archives and watching some old new Trek.
And yep, I am too. So the Wall Street Journal did a profile on these folks yesterday or the day before, and about six different people sent it my way. So I was happy to learn of their existence through that. And it was really focused on the whole act of what an uber fan James Colley is for having taken right. these blueprints and set up in an old grocery store these very, very faithfully reproduced sets. And then it's sort of as a side note, and by the way, he's been doing a web series in the sets for quite some time, which looks really good, actually. I mean, for, you know, it probably doesn't have the budget and special effects, et cetera, that Axanar seems to have if you look at their trailer and such, but it looks very entertaining, and the fact that they
nailed
involved
the hairstyles.
Yes.
And the furniture. Totally nailed the hairstyles.
Yes.
Actually, and the one who plays the Spock wannabe, the Vulcan character, they really did well with that one. The ears, the prosthetics, everything looks just about what you would expect from the old series. But, you know, right. Denise, Emery, I want to ask you, you know, specifically a legal question here, which is, we hear often that you have to defend your copyright because if you don't defend it, it goes away. But how much do you have to defend? Because I've got a couple of friends who actually do work for CBS. And the way that they were explaining it to me was that the studio is doing the bare minimum to maintain copyright. But Is that right? Because this does not sound like bare minimum. This sounds like maximum.
I think you're incorrect, actually. Yeah, and Denise, feel free to take this away.
I think you're confusing a couple of different types of IP law. The one where you have to really defend it, even though you might want to let some incidents slide, is the trademark arena.
Oh, that's okay.
Like, which is still relevant here.
Yeah,
so that's why they're not going to allow anyone to use the word Star Trek. You can't put that anywhere in your production. And it has to say this is a Star Trek fan production.
Well, I mean, just even saying that this is a Star Trek fan production is, you know, using their trademark, which is why it makes this all, you know, the whole fan film and fan art community such a such a sticky subject. Because, yeah, you know, copyright, you don't at all have to defend your copyright. Trademark, you do have a sort of use it or lose it and defend it or lose it to dilution. But on the other hand, yeah, you know, the question of fair use comes up, and is there is no fair use for trademarks, but obviously this is the sort of thing that, you know, wouldn't necessarily cause consumer confusion, which is sort of the root, you know, the policy reasoning behind trademarks and, you know, the policy reasoning behind why you have to defend your trademark. I don't think that today we have that. I don't think that's the case today. I think that, you know, we as consumers are, you know, experienced enough, sophisticated enough to recognize that this film is not made by CBS, that this is a Star Trek fan film. So, you know, Denise, if you want to take it away from here. Yeah.
The thing that we don't have any law professors on the show today, an unusual thing for our show, but the one thing that stands out to me, well, there are several nuggets you could pull out of these fact patterns and drill down on whether it's infringement or fair use. But as far as James Colley is concerned, they're doing a lot of the things that Axanar is doing. They're using characters and costumes, designs of makeup, like Vulcan ears. And I think those are all things that have been complained about in the Axanar lawsuit, in addition to use of the Klingon language. But the faithfully reproducing the sets thing, I think, would be a really meaty issue to get into and analyze. You know, if you've been given the blueprints, and I'm sure there was no sort of authorized transfer of the blueprints. It was just kind of like, I have these and here you go. And then you actually act on them and build this stuff out and use it. The one thing that New Voyages never did, I think they did raise money to help, you know, pay for the production, et cetera, but it's never been a profit oriented enterprise that they were covering their expenses. So, I think that certainly probably factored into CBS and Paramount taking a hands-off approach. Look, these are just ardent fans. Nobody's making any money here. It's just a labor of love and devotion. That's not their legal obligation to let a labor of love and devotion persist, but I'm sure it comes into the mix when they're deciding whether or not to sue. So I'd love to see a law professor put on an exam. You know, someone faithfully reproduces the original series sets. You know, what discuss the causes of action and defenses, because there would be several. That's about I've got on this, Rourke's, unless you guys want to weigh in with anything else.
I just have one quick thought that I thought Rourke's in the chat brought up a good point or a good idea. You know, in copyright, for music copyright, there are, you know, mandatory licenses that, you know, people have to be able to, and same in patents. There's, you know, a reasonable royalty that you can pay to do a cover song. So I wonder if we might see something come down the pike where, you know, fan art is sort of treated similarly, where, you know, CBS might be forced to offer a reasonable royalty in order for fan projects like this to be, you know, created. But again, this is that's going to have to come down to the courts. You know, this is this whole idea of, that's why I was, you know, a little wary of the news back when CBS was sort of working with Axanar directly, because that only literally helps Axanar in CBS. It doesn't make it any more clear for the rest of us about, you know, what we're operating under. So it'd be very interesting to follow this as it develops.
Also, there's an interesting workplace crossover here, because, again, one of the 10 guidelines is any fan production cannot have anybody, actors, directors, crew, that worked on an actual official Star Trek production. Can you actually do that? Because that sounds like in perpetuity. If you've ever had anything to do with a studio that has been producing something for Paramount, CBS that involves Star Trek, automatically it means you cannot do this thing that might be a paying gig. Is that legal?
It depends on the state. Different states have different approaches to non-compete clauses when you've wrapped up a job. And I'm sure somewhere there is a table that tells you what the different laws are in different states. In California does not recognize non-compete restrictions except in limited circumstances. The general rule is if somebody slips that kind of language into your departure agreement when you leave a job, it's probably not going to be enforceable in California, but that's just here.
And can non-competes ever be in perpetuity?
No, I don't think. I think that would be a problem too. In the states where they're enforceable. What do you think, Emery? You're closer to adhesion contract terms and what constitutes one than I am right now, having had contracts
I was thinking about the idea that you know, non-compete clauses are in California, you know, can bar you, or sorry, they can't prevent you specifically, you, from working at another place. But this is not exactly the same situation, where this is the business saying that you can't make this artistic project that includes the names or faces of people that were identified, you know, that were in the copyrighted works.
No, that's
before.
A good point.
So it is slightly different. I don't think that any in perpetuity non-compete clause would ever be enforceable. But yeah, it is a meaty, thick, you know, weighty issue. So I'll defer to some law professor we'll have on in a future date.
You know, Victor Rule weighed in here. He was saying how this reminds him of several cases that have gone through fandom at comic conventions, because you've got artists from very popular comics who will come to these conventions and sell their art, which of course looks a little bit like the art that they drew for those old comics. And you had studios coming after them saying, no, we own that. And the artist saying, wait, no, you can't own my style. It could be the same thing here. It's like, wait a minute, just because I was an extra in Beyond Darkness or whatever it was, the last film that we had that was bad, just because I was in the background at some point, it doesn't mean that I can never have an acting gig again. I don't know.
I mean, let's put this in the context of the Batmobile case. Let's say pretending that the Batmobile was a person physically in a Batcar suit, which I'm just imagining now as I'm saying is ridiculous. But anyways, Yeah, we've said that, you know, the Batmobile is a recognizable, copyrightable character that is, you know, that is itself copyrightable. So under that, sorry, didn't mean to shake the camera, but yeah, under that context, yeah, you know, individual characters have been said to be copyrightable, unique elements that can be infringed upon. So in that light, that's where I'm not necessarily sure if this is, you know, correct to cast this in like a non-compete light as much as a, you know, copyright and even trademark issue. So
copyright in the character, yeah. And just the Batmobile as a person in a suit reminds me of the Horta from the original series, which I think was just a person under a blanket, although I could be mistaken.
Okay, you
all
are
the
geek.
Nerd props. Yes, all the nerd props.
It looked like a person under a blanket. Anyway, let us move on. I just wanted to mention, I forget who it was in IRC, but it was a funny comment, Padre, that we're really doing This Week in Enterprise Tech right now. So,
show name.
Yes, possibly. Let's move on and look at... You were just not a fan of the Beyond movie, Padre. I'm wondering if you're going along with what seemed to be the negative reviews of No Man's Sky. We have the game. My son seems to like it and hasn't read the negative reviews, so I'm not putting him in front of him because he seems to enjoy wandering around the infinite universe, and who am I to spoil his fun? but spoiling the fun of the folks who tried to do No Mario's Sky... were rapidly Nintendo's lawyers. No Mario Sky was a cute little 2D game incorporating Mario characters running through an infinite machine-generated space universe. Super cute concept, I'm sure. You know, again, just sort of one of these fan homage labors of love that was
a legitimately cool concept.
Yeah.
I think that is a very cool game. I would love to play a Mario game, 2D side-scrolling Mario that procedurally generates an infinite world. Are you kidding me? That sounds amazing. And it was made in like a 3-day game jam. But yes, of course, the news this week was that No Mario Sky was shut down from a copyright order from Nintendo. Of course, the next day it popped up as the aptly named DMCA Sky. So you can still find it as DMCA Sky, no longer Mario Sprites, trying to save the Princess Mango. So,
yes.
I remember when I first heard about this, it was there was a whole group of us who were going, wait a minute, there's no way this is going to happen. I mean, Nintendo doesn't even want you broadcasting their games without some sort of compensation. Yeah. So, of course, they're not going to let you make a playable video game that uses their most popular character.
Yeah.
Right. Your
hot take was right on. There's no way that, you know, Nintendo has not been the most kind to fan projects or fan games. You're not going to be able to make your own Mario game anytime shortly.
Right. The DMCA's Sky folks say they're the replacement for No Mario Sky. Does this remind you at all, Padre, of when Napster was put out of business and then there was Grokster and every other stir you could think of that sprung up to fill that void just a little bit?
This is the response of the internet. Sure, you can take us down legally, and then you're going to spend the next 20 years playing whack-a-mole because we'll come up with every variation of this we can think of. And when you tell us to take it down, we'll take it down, and then something else will sprout out. This is generally what happens when you provoke the trolls. And I mean the trolls in the good sense, the ones who are saying, wait a minute, this is strange. If we're your fans, if we're the ones who are supporting you, why are you suing us?
Mm-hmm. So DMCA Sky, in that, we're not using Mario characters at all. It's a very Mario-looking sort of scenario. But you are helping Spaceman... Finn search for Princess Mango in an infinite universe that may contain no mangoes. made in 72 hours for Ludum Dare 36. So that is out there for your downloading and playing pleasure still. Padre, I have this in the rundown for you because knowing how much how near and dear to your heart Pokemon Go is, and also the inside of a church might be. Have you been paying attention to the Russian blogger who decided that Russia's rule about I'm not sure if the rule specifically prohibited Pokemon Go in a church, if that's what he got riled up about, or just he wasn't supposed to be using his phone in a church. But he decided to go flaunt that and marched into the church and promptly started playing Pokemon Go. And the fact that the video of him was out there and available and much watched online wound up sending him, making him face charges for various disrespecting of the church property. Again, I don't think the Russian legal system takes this lightly at all. So there's sort of a lot of issues in the mix here. Being a political dissident, wanting to protest the laws seems to come into play. There are many people who were using the hashtag free Sokolovsky in Russian, trying to speak up for his having done commentary on the law against Pokemon Go in a church. So as it is right now, he is not in a good way. He's going to have to face these harsh charges in Russia because of the acts portrayed in this video here. And all of this just made me so happy that when I was wandering around Westminster Abbey with a school group this last summer, that Pokemon Go had not been released yet. Because you are definitely not supposed to be using your phone in any way, shape, or form in lots of sacred spaces. And Westminster Abbey is certainly one of them. So, Padre, what's your take on all this?
Well, I don't know the laws in Russia. I did not realize they actually have a law that says you cannot, what, use electronics in a church? Or is that actually a thing?
I'm not sure.
I don't actually
exactly
think it was.
What he was so charged with.
So Yaroslav Nilov, head of the state's Duma's Religious Affairs Committee, according to him, he said, "In my opinion, catching Pokemon is not an insult to religious feelings because it's simply the use of a mobile phone application within religious buildings." So given that quote, I don't think that there's a law that says that you're not allowed to use the electronic devices in religious buildings. Specifically, mm-hmm. though, there was a law that said, or there was, you know, order passed down from on high that it was, you know, There are laws against rather inciting hatred and insulting religious feelings.
Hate speech statute.
Yes, and so they're saying that playing Pokemon Go specifically as a counterculture YouTuber who has been an activist himself, that makes it hate speech. So,
I've actually encountered this at least three of the different parishes that I've pastored at, where you will have people who will deliberately come into the church during an active service to disrupt. And it's very simple. We first ask them to please not do that. And if they don't, we ask them to please leave the property. I've never actually had to call the police to remove somebody. But in his case, it sounds like this is something that he's doing to drum up attention. And this is his stance. This is his thing. He's anti-clerical, which is fine. Again, I'm not really familiar with the laws in Russia, but in the United States, you could play Pokemon in my church, and the most I'll do is ask you to please stop doing it, and then I'll probably turn on my cell phone jammer, and your game will end.
Is that illegal?
That's very illegal, by the way.
Yeah. I'm going to say, we're going to talk about that a little later with some counter-drone tech, but...
Yes. All right, yeah, as long as we're doing... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it is... the idea of using these augmented reality apps as some form of civil disobedience, I think, is a really interesting sort of precedent. I'm interested to see if, we see more things like this. I'm not sure if he was as much anti-clerical as anti-Putin, but, I don't know if it really makes that much of a difference right now.
Right.
Best of luck to Sokolovsky.
Sokolovsky, yeah.
Yes.
And by the way, I should mention that I did actually use Pokemon Go in a homily during a mass, and no one came and took me away.
No, but you merely mentioned it. You weren't playing it for the benefit of your congregation.
It was actually part of my homily. I started my homily by taking my phone, going, "Oh, look, Pikachu!" And when I looked up, there was at least half the congregation had their phones up. So I was like, "Okay, well, that's how many people play." Got it.
Got it. Wonderful. A little bit more lighthearted, but nonetheless, still on the theme of governments being concerned with when, where, and how people are playing Pokemon Go. We mentioned on, I believe it was last week's show, the city of Milwaukee wanting Niantic to follow its county's permitting process for geocaching so that they become a responsible party as people are playing Pokemon Go in the city. Milwaukee's taken a lot of blowback for this, and they're struggling. Chris Abiel is an official in the city. He's the county, actually, he's the county executive, and has issued a statement that at least is worth mentioning for his sort of feeble attempt at punning his way out of a PR problem. He says, "I believe that the county's Poke coins should be spent investing in new amenities everyone can enjoy, expanding our urban parks initiative and upgrading more parks to be ADA accessible, not on additional park patrols and cleanup crews necessitated by a few bad crabbies who won't pick up their muck. That's why we've asked Niantic, the developer of Pokemon Go, to simply follow our documented permitting process for geocaching so they can share in the responsibility of maintaining these spaces. It's not a mystic request. More than 400 local users have applied for and received these permits over the past 8 years, and we think large corporations should be held to the same standards. To be clear, simply playing Pokemon Go doesn't require a permit. That would be tentacruel to ask of people who are just trying to get outside and explore our parks. Milwaukee County parks are open, and we want more people to Pikachu's them today and every day." So his tortured puns aside, he's still sticking by what I think has gotten them in trouble in the first place, and that is that Niantic, who has a virtual overlay on their actual spaces, should be should go through a similar permitting process. He keeps bringing up geocaching, but he also says more than 400 other users have applied for and received these permits. Any further thoughts on this, Emery?
Yeah, I do have a couple of thoughts on this. I think this is I've realized now that I'm abusing the word interesting, but this is a really great show. But I think that, you know, the idea that, you know, these augmented reality apps, well, first off, I hadn't realized that there was a permit process for geocaching. I think that alone is kind of interesting. I hadn't, you know, the fact that we haven't heard much about it is simply because, you know, if that law has been on the books and companies are complying with it, you know, geocaching isn't nearly as popular as Pokemon Go. But the idea that augmented reality apps like Pokemon Go are going to continue to develop, and they are going to be based around getting people to specific locations in the real world, I do think there is, you know, an interesting argument to be made. I am a little more sympathetic, I think, than a lot of the internet to the Milwaukee parks. Not that I think that the law currently requires Niantic to go through any kind of permit process to get their users to them. I think that probably the CDA would insulate Niantic from the actions of their users. But that being said, should it? You know, this sort of brings into mind the problem of Airbnb. You know, is Airbnb just this sort of communications platform that facilitates communication between users and people that want to rent? Yes, but there are also real world, physical, you know, meet space, brick and mortar context to that. And, you know, it has, you know, negative effects on the real people that are actually living there. And the same can be said about these augmented reality apps. They're sort of claiming ownership over this digital space that happens to be overlaid directly on the real physical space that does have real ownership. So, you know, how is this going to shake out? I don't know. But frankly, I think that the Milwaukee park system brings up a great point. If, you know, I, for example, if I wanted to have a huge party at Balboa Park and I just started posting on Facebook, "Hey, everyone, we're going to have a huge party at Balboa Park," and they all showed up, that would, you know, that wouldn't be cool. that would be, you know, I would require a permit for that. The fact that this company is sort of algorithmically or semi-automatically placing, you know, rare Pokemon in certain places or using, you know, whatever incentives they, you know, they use to get people to move to different places, I'm not sure if that doesn't involve them a little more with the actual, meat space that they're, you know, directing their users to.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's going to be interesting, as you say, to watch what happens in Milwaukee here and see if they actually do get Niantic to cooperate in the permit process. And if they don't get them to cooperate in the permit process, what they do next about it. Padre, any thoughts?
Well, I was getting ready to sort of just blast Milwaukee for not understanding the difference between real world and the digital world. But Emery actually, I really get it. I understand it. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with the whole idea of holding a party. If I was going to hold a party in Golden Gate Park here in San Francisco, I would get a permit. Even if if I brought a bounce house, I think I need 3 permits to do that in Golden Gate Park. But on the other hand, if you look at the actual county park page of Milwaukee, they do show off the 2 types of geocaching that are allowed, and they call it physical geocaching, and that's when you actually have a physical item and you hide it someplace and people have to find it, and it's like a little treasure hunt based on GPS coordinates. In fact, Patrick Delahanty plays it here at Twit. But then virtual caching, they're trying to lump in the same category as physical geocaching. And although I agree with you, Emery, I think there's also a recognition that it's not the same thing. People don't actually have to find something physical. They're not tearing up the land like they would if they were looking for a box that has been hidden behind a log next to a lake. This is all in digital space. So to ask for the same kind of permitting in virtual space as in real space, that part seems still not to make sense for me. I mean, require something, because you are hosting a party, whether or not you want to admit it. But it's not the same as hosting a party in real space, as actually inviting all those people to come to one place to participate in one event.
Absolutely. So, yeah. No, I am right there with you. I don't want to say that, you know, it is supposed to be exactly the same permit process, but I do have sympathy to the idea that this is a new area that isn't neatly grouped into either of our previously existing categories, and that this new category of augmented reality isn't just a Wild West where it's just totally not real. You know, there are real world repercussions and consequences to the augmented reality apps. So yeah, be keeping my eyes peeled on this.
Right. My final thought on this is, you're talking about how it doesn't fit into our pre-existing boxes. And just to cross back over to Twiat for a minute for you, Padre, what I've noticed over the last several years in this discussion is a prime example of why it's happening, is how many companies now, in addition to their general counsel, have a chief policy officer. Right. It seems to be kind of a de rigueur thing. If you're doing anything even remotely pushing the envelope of tech and policy, to have someone who tries to grapple with these thorny issues for you. And that's a new thing that did not exist when I came out of law school, and is a perfect kind of role for someone like Emery when he does. So, it's just kind of it's an interesting development, that there's a necessity for that kind of thing, because we just don't know. You know, I mean, these are complicated, thorny issues, and the law doesn't give us precise, formulaic answers for how they should come out. So, all right. In a moment, we're going to talk about a Guinness World Record that you might not have known Game of Thrones has earned itself. But first, we're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Blue Apron. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Save time and money. Shopping at the grocery store is 60% more expensive than Blue Apron. If you spend a lot eating out or at high-end grocery chains, you can now spend under $10 per person for a healthy home-cooked meal. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences and choose your delivery option that fits your precise needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. And Blue Apron now delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. That's somewhat staggering to me because I remember when they first started out as a sponsor and I first started using them, we would get emails from folks in Texas and other middle of the country states saying, please, please, when do we get our Blue Apron? Well, you've got it now. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Seafood is sourced sustainably. Beef is raised humanely. Chickens are free range. Pork is raised naturally. And regenerative farming practices are used for produce. By shipping the exact amount required for the recipe, Blue Apron is reducing food waste. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron brings you the best. Blue Apron not only supports a more sustainable food system, it supports happy and healthy families. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. This is great now that school has started. I know everybody's schedules constrict when that happens. It's just one less thing to worry about. You know you've got two or three great meals, all the ingredients pre-measured with instructions sitting there in the fridge when you get home from collecting folks in the family and get everyone home at the end of the day. And then you can easily send into the kitchen to take care of that cooking responsibility someone who may not be your family's go-to chef, and they can do a great job. That's a really cool, empowering thing for families. New recipes are created every week by Blue Apron's culinary team and are not repeated within a year. Paprika spiced shrimp and cheddar grits with tomato and sweet corn is something you might want to sample. Summer udon noodle salad with cherry tomatoes, corn, and summer sweet pepper. Spicy hoisin chicken stir fry with baby bok choy and sesame ginger cucumber salad. You can just almost taste the freshness of the vegetables and the variety of the ingredients just in taking in what some of those selections are. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Visit blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your help in my kitchen and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, so Game of Thrones. I was not aware until I saw this article that this is not the first but the fourth year that Game of Thrones has actually won a place in the Guinness Book of World Records for being the most pirated TV show. But this is its fourth year. Torrent Freak, I think, is where they're getting their download information, and it clocks them at 14.4 million illegal downloads of the drama per episode. This being the fourth consecutive year it's taken that title, and also the title of most Emmy nominations for a TV series. So, or most Emmy awards, not just nominated, but won by a TV series in one season. It won 12 Emmy awards for season 5, dominating the West Wing. The Download Award, wasn't aware, just wanted to mention it. Emery, any thoughts on it?
No, I mean, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all. Game of Thrones is, you know, that sort of perfect confluence of a wildly successful, excellently produced, very interesting, sexy, violent show that is also on HBO. So not nearly as many people have access to it already. And then, you know, the technology is just getting easier and easier to pirate. So, you know, I think that Game of Thrones is going to hold this record until the next, you know, breakaway success comes when people don't want to pay for it.
Right.
I mean, I got nothing on it. Congrats,
okay.
Game of Thrones.
Padre, anything on Game of Thrones before we move on?
This is a very interesting case, and I think this is something that's going to be studied by studios. As Emery said, the next one that has the major breakout, because they could have done the traditional approach. And the traditional approach is you sic your lawyers on anyone who even has the scent of supporting piracy. And of course, mm-hmm. that includes YouTube, because on YouTube, it's not 14.4 million. It's hundreds of millions, if not billions of views of clips of every mm-hmm. episode that get uploaded literally 5 minutes after it's shown. I mean, there's people who are just, they're just chugging it out. And yes, they do takedowns on YouTube, but I've seen some of those clips stay up for months and months at a time before they finally get the takedown. So it would be interesting to sit in the HBO boardroom and hear what is their justification for not going double-barreled with the legal approach. Are they saying, look, it's PR is good PR no matter what, as long as people know that the show's out there, as long as people know that it's popular, as long as people know that they're willing to pirate this because it is such a well-made piece of content. And if they think that actually drives sales to HBO because that's how they make their money. You subscribe to the channel. They don't sell advertising. And this could be one of these things where people point and say, see, piracy doesn't necessarily hurt you if you handle it the right way, which is something that the internet has been screaming since Napster.
Right. Yep. Well, here's an example of handling it the wrong way. It's something that comes up again and again. It's certainly not the first time this has happened, but I saw that you tweeted this, Padre, so wanted to just let the world know that it's still happening, and that is right hand not knowing what left hand is doing, and studios hiring, of course, they have to hire companies to handle their voluminous download, or not download, but DMCA takedown requests. Here, this was a company called Vobile working on behalf of Warner Brothers that, whoopsie, asked for the official pages of Batman The Dark Knight, the Matrix films, to have material taken down. And also the movie The Lucky One, all these Warner Brothers properties that its own subcontractor decided were not operating within the law, even though they are the most authorized way that those materials can be online. They also accidentally sent perfectly legitimate streaming activities, or tried to censor legitimate streaming activities of properties on Amazon, Sky, and IMDb. So this is not how you want to handle your DMCA needs. And of course, the counter argument to scoffing at this is that the system is broken, that the obligation on studios to police this is so huge and out of hand that they wind up getting in these embarrassing situations. But it is the way the law requires them to conduct themselves now, is to go ahead and send download notices when and as they find that something unauthorized is online. They certainly could hire a company that's more competent at it than Vobile seems to have been here. Emery, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that I think you hit it on the nail on the head that, you know, first off, the DMCA is a hugely important piece of law. You know, it allows the internet to function. Without the DMCA, you know, the face of the internet would be completely different. And we were, you know, people that there are lots of creative people that rely on the DMCA exactly as it was intended to do, as it was intended to, you know, support their business. But at the same time, yeah, I think that both sides of the aisle agree that the system is a little broken. You know, yeah, the responsibility of the publishers to or the copyright holders to sort of police the internet and send these requests is huge. But at the same time, the DMCA doesn't have any meaningful limitations or restrictions on sending, you know, spurious claims, or, you know, that basically the letter of the law encourages, basically requires these copyright holders to send out mass takedown requests because there's no real, you know, slap on the wrist otherwise. You know, when talking about DMCA reform, you know, people on the one side, you hear people like Warner Brothers say that you need a system called, you know, takedown and stay down, where after a takedown request is sent, the website is required to actually police its own content and make sure that content like it stays down. On the opposite side, we see that, you know, we have calls for strengthening of Section 512F, which is the section that, you know, places repercussions on sending spurious claims. You know, Warner Brothers and publishers like them like to pretend, or like to, you know, explain this as saying that, you know, these sort of things never happen, or that they happen so rarely that, you know, it's inconsequential. But these things do happen. Incorrect, you know, takedown requests do get sent out, you know, sometimes by accident, sometimes on purpose. And things like this happened, where Warner Brothers, you know, lawyers sent themselves a takedown request. I think that, you know, if we were to, there is probably an article about a company sending a bad takedown request for some of their own content once every other week or so that we don't highlight, just because it's, you know, pretty part and parcel. So yeah, does DMCA need some kind of reworking? Yes. How does that happen and balance the interests of, you know, publishers and internet, you know, at the same time? It is a very thorny issue that I don't think anyone has a solution to.
Right. My head is just spinning at the thought of Warner Brothers answering their own DMCA takedown by saying, you didn't do a proper analysis of whether fair use would have applied here. Oh, wait, no.
Warner Brothers be Warner Brothers.
Yes. Padre, any thoughts? Yeah.
Well, I agree with both of you. I think the system is absolutely broken, and the studios are the ones who broke it. I mean, they've been doing automated and shotgun DMCA takedown notices for so long that I'm sure legal didn't even notice that, oh, that's our address. Interesting. There's another level to the story, which is when they sent the takedown to Google, Google recognized the error. The studio didn't, but Google's like, I'm pretty sure you don't want to take yourself down. There's part of me that would have loved to see Google say, well, you said we need to listen to what you say no matter what. So we're going to take you down. And then you have to go through the process of reversing, of replying to your own DMCA takedown. I think that would have just warmed the cockles of my heart because it would be a studio getting its own medicine.
Yeah.
That's hysterical. All right. Let us take a trip to Germany. And I know, Padre, that you probably weren't only concerned with privacy considerations at IFA, but that's what I wanted to pick your brain about the Consumer Electronics Show you were just attending. So IFA, I know you had tons of fun there and saw tons of cool stuff, but I was hoping you could hone in for us on the Internet of Things and any particular developments that you saw, caught your eye, caught your attention concerning the extent to which our devices are watching, listening to us, and logging our personal information in hackable ways.
So there was a few items. First of all, it is definitely an Internet of Things. You could walk through the various pavilions, and it's set up differently than a tech conference that you would have in the United States, where you get this huge hall with a mashup. I mean, you did walk through the Panasonic pavilion and the Samsung pavilion and the Sony pavilion, but every device is connected. Every device is gathering information, and every vendor has some sort of wonderful magic screen that shows you the benefit of letting your devices listen and watch you, which that's all good. But then there was a subcurrent that was running at IFA with Kaspersky, the well-known antivirus manufacturer. They were there in a big way, and their big push wasn't hardware. Their big push was, we want to work with the Internet of Things vendors to make the Internet of Things a secure Internet of Things. And I did drop in on one of the talks, and I read some of the literature, and after about 5 minutes, I just said, this is like every talk that I've heard about the Internet of Things over the last 3 years. A lot of words about finally making it secure, but no real way to actually do it. Because in order for you to make the Internet of Things secure, you have to get buy-in from the manufacturers to use standard protocols and standard ways of talking between their devices, and they just won't do that. So I you know, the takeaway for me as a person in networking was, good idea, but there's no way, shape, or form that a secure Internet of Things is going to happen on the consumer level. It's going to happen on the enterprise and then maybe trickle down, which was actually very disappointing. I was hoping to hear some vendor who had come up with some way to entice all the competition to join on a single platform.
It's notable.
I think you brought up.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I think that you brought up, you know, a great point that this is exactly the conversation that people that have been paying attention to this have been saying for about 3 years. You know, nothing really has changed. That, you know, the same lines that basically all of these, you know, all of these gadgets are just gadgets that are poorly made or poorly secured, at least, and connected to the internet, and they're going to be depreciated in a few years and then never receive support afterwards. You know, I think that Steve Gibson's recommendation on Security Now about the Internet of Things like 3 years ago probably still holds true, that you should just have a separate router for your separate network of Internet of Things gadgets at your house. And otherwise, don't put anything else on it, because as we've seen in the Kaspersky report, you know, the norm is that passwords are sent in the plain text, or that, you know, they're actively backdoored, or, you know, actively spying on you. And it's just incredible. As a huge nerd, as a huge geek, I can't tell you how much I want an Internet of Things refrigerator. I would love it. Mm-hmm. Like, if I could like look at my phone and know what's in the refrigerator and not have to open it up, I'd be all about that. But yes, I don't want my insurance company knowing that, you know, it's like 90% chocolate, you know? Like, why is it so hard to, you know, and this brings back to the, you know, the larger discussion about privacy policies that we have over and over again on this show, that, you know, there is not only is there not a, like, an actual universal standard for how they make it physically work, how they make the security work hardware wise, software wise, but there isn't a standard way of how you give notice to consumers, how consumers are aware or made aware of what these devices are actually doing. Because as we've seen before, these privacy policies that are sure accompanying all of these devices and, you know, little 6-point font folded up in a piece of paper underneath the device when you open the box, you know, they're not going to be readable at all. I would not only love to see a sort of standardization of the security model, which I think is a huge far away goal, but I think just as far away of a goal is seeing some kind of standardization in the notice model or in the privacy model. And that's, you know, something that obviously privacy advocates and, you know, people have been talking about trying to get on just internet websites for decades now, that isn't really making much ground. I'm pretty pessimistic on this, Padre, and your report doesn't really offer much encouragement.
Yeah, and I'm with you. The only way that we've learned to secure the Internet of Things is to make it its own network and just assume that all those devices have been owned and therefore they should touch nothing that you actually need, of course, then makes
them a lot less useful.
Yeah, they're not really useful if you can't trust the information that you're getting from. Here's an example. We were walking through the Haier Pavilion, which was a German manufacturer that was purchased by a Chinese company. And they had a row of TVs, and they also had an internet-connected refrigerator that they said also acted as a Wi-Fi hotspot. So I whipped out my phone, and I connected to that hotspot. And then I was running a Fing, which is just a network tool that you can run on Android. And I was noticing all these other devices that were connected to the same network. I do a little bit of digging, and it's the wall of hundreds of TVs that they have. And they all have Miracast enabled and not protected. And I'm thinking, if I was a bad person, I would be able to throw any video up on all these TVs and they would automatically start playing it. And I'm like, well,
yeah.
I mean, if you can't secure it in a booth that you control like this, then what hope do I have that you're going to be able to keep me safe if I install this in my home?
And the problem is that these companies aren't
treat all of IFA to a few episodes of Twiet, knowing that.
I probably should have done that. I should have just started broadcasting, you know, new screensavers or something. But you know, I'm not malicious like that. But I was looking at this going, this is weak. This is really, really weak. Yeah. I mean, I know you've got privacy settings that you can turn on. The fact that you've turned on none of them and that they're not turned on by default means that if a consumer buys this, of course, they're not going to turn it on. And therefore, I will have the same access to this through their refrigerator that I would, you know, if it was in my house. And this is another one of those things where you would actually have your security hurt if you bought multiple appliances from the same vendor. And that's not what you want to hear. You want to hear, hey, if you stay in our ecosystem, well, we know how to run everything. And that's just not the reality.
I mean, I do think there is a negligence suit.
Let me ask you guys one thing, since you brought it up a couple of times, putting the devices on their own network. But if the devices are having you log into other accounts and put your passwords directly into them, does it matter if they're on their own network? You're already giving up that information without anyone having to worm their way through your network to get to it.
Well, the idea of putting it on its own network is it's a network that you don't trust. So everyone should have the network that they trust and the network that they don't trust. And the network they don't trust is what they would allow their friends to connect to.
Except that your Amazon, you know, Echo would be on the network you don't trust, and that does have access to your credit card information.
Right.
I mean, thankfully, Amazon's a little bit better than a lot of these people about, you know, building security into their devices. But yeah, Denise, you're absolutely right. You know, any of these devices that want to do the cool stuff that we're talking about, like automatically buy me groceries when it recognizes that I'm out of chocolate, you know, yeah, that's going to access my personal information and send it apparently in the clear, you know, over the airwaves. And I think that that's really, you know, I have sort of brought this up before when we're talking about Internet of Things. There's got to be some kind of negligence here eventually. Like, it's going to come down to a negligence suit because these companies are releasing these devices that are just painfully insecure and purposefully so almost, you know, egregiously so at the very least. And then, yeah, dropping support for them after a couple of years or 5 years. And that is just not sustainable. If we're going to have security in the consumer models, then that's the only route I see to it.
Yeah. And Exhibit A in one of those negligence suits is going to have to be the results of the last 2 years, the Internet of Things village at DEF CON, where they just turn people loose to hack these things and the various results of those hacking endeavors, which I guess it, not this year, but last year, the hackers uncovered 66 different zero-day vulnerabilities previously unknown and unfixed security issues across 28 different devices from 18 different manufacturers. And this year it got, I think, incrementally better, except for they were still finding, let's see, things, locks that could be opened via a smartphone.
Ransomware thermostat was my favorite.
Yes, the ransomware that, you know, thermostat is awesome. You cannot turn up the heat until you pay us.
Yeah.
$10 million. Yeah.
I mean, imagine, you know, your smart refrigerator saying, okay, you're going to pay us about half a Bitcoin, or we're just going to turn off the air, you know, we're going to turn off the cooling and let all the food in your refrigerator and freezer go bad. Well, totally a possibility. That could totally happen. That is
the big one from,
like,
last year's village. So last year at DEF CON, I was in the IoT village, and they had SCADA devices, actual supervisory control and data acquisition devices that they used to do things like control power plants and water mains. And it was funny because within the first, I'd say, hour of the show, there were a couple of people who were able to get into the SCADA device. Because remember, they're not designed to be protected. They weren't ever really designed to be on the internet. But they were able to get into them and then reprogram them and have them play Tetris. They actually had the display screen showing Tetris and they were playing it remotely. And that was a fun example. But then you start thinking, if I have enough control over a SCADA device to reprogram it and load Tetris, it means I have absolute control over anything it's connected to. And if it just happens to be one of the SCADA devices that says controls a gas main, I could shut off the gas and then turn it back on and watch things explode because I've just made a lot of pilot lights go off. And it's, it was that sort of stuff where it's like, okay, slow down. Internet of Things should not mean Internet of Things that should never be on the internet. and that's unfortunately where we're at.
Right. So you're telling me that when my Samsung fridge starts Tetris on its view screen, I should be concerned?
No, play. I think try to get the high score.
The sad thing is you would never get that kind of warning. You would just be pwned, and that would be that. So, sadly. Okay, so the FTC doesn't want you to have a similar...
Oh, by the way, wait. I just realized also the route for, you know, phishing attacks. Like, if we're talking about how vulnerable people are to phishing, which is, you know, the when people strategically, or spear phishing, I guess, when people, you know, do enough research into you to know that you had a doctor's appointment yesterday. You know, this sort of Internet of Homes vulnerability makes that sort of attack much easier, you know, than the amount of very personal knowledge that might not even be related to your credit card information or your social security number. And you wouldn't necessarily think it's compromising information, but, you know, they would know.
Oh, God, you're so right.
So be afraid.
Yeah, having a calendar on a screen in your kitchen is definitely one of the things people want. That's where you want your calendar, not in your pocket or on your desk somewhere elsewhere in the house. You need it where you're doing your stuff and starting your day. And only you need it and not the people who want to spearfish you. The FTC doesn't want you to similarly get in trouble when you rent a car and connect your phone. This is kind of a rock or a hard place issue, because if you're going to rent a car and you've got your smartphone with you, pretty much, of course, you're going to connect it to the car to be able to drive hands-free. And in California, you couldn't use it in the car unless you did that. So the FTC has warned you, though, that if, you know, I think they pretty much said here that you shouldn't connect just for charging. If you do connect to the car, you should try and tailor what information you want the system to access. Hopefully you'll be able to grant it access just so you can use the car hands-free. You don't need to upload your phone book so that it's more convenient to tell it to call Betty. And then again, I'm not quite sure how easy it is to do this. Maybe it's just by disconnecting the device from the car when you're done with the rental, which is probably about the last thing people are thinking of as they're scrambling to get all their bags and make their flight and turning over the keys. But if you take that extra step and disconnect it from the car, you know, at least doing that would be helpful. What you would ideally want to do is delete your data. So Padre, being as savvy as you are about these things and as travel weary as you are, how do you personally handle this issue? I'm sure you've connected your phone to a car, right?
I never, ever, ever, ever connect via Bluetooth, ever. I actually carry an analog 3.5 millimeter to 3.5 millimeter cable with me so I can plug into the external audio port. That's the only connection I will have with a rental car. And there's a simple reason for that. If the in-dash system has been designed properly, then when it pairs with your Bluetooth device, it should only access contacts and the phone from the phone. It should not store anything locally except for the Bluetooth connection information. Unfortunately, there's no guarantee that it's a properly manufactured head unit. You do have head units out there that will get access to your contacts, and then not maliciously, but in order to speed up service, they'll copy contacts to the local memory. They're not supposed to do that, but they do. We actually found a couple of those at DEF CON. And once I find one that does that, I assume that they'll all do that. And I don't want my contacts or any of my other Bluetooth accessible information to exist in a unit that I have no control over. Because, you know, as you mentioned, you should delete your information. You should delete the pairing when you leave the car. But there is no menu to delete the entire memory of that unit.
Right.
And it's just, you know, I'm sorry, that's how it works. It may be fine in 99% of the cases, but that it only takes that one case for someone to have enough personal information for them to make my life miserable.
Yep. True. And it's not just Bluetooth either. I mean, you know, the day we all know not to pick up USB drives and plug them into your computer, obviously. But, you know, the idea that, you know, when you're at the airport, you see these charging kiosks and you just go ahead and plug your phone into it, you know, or just the idea of plugging your phone anytime you take that USB cord and you plug it into something that you don't own or you hadn't, you know, don't have direct control over. I think it's a risk.
Wow. And here I was so thrilled to see that ski resorts are starting to put charging stations in the lodge where you pick up your chili for lunch. You see all these cords snaking out of the wall, just there to give you that last little bit of juice that you need for the afternoon skiing. But you're right. Someone can download your information.
Padre knows better than I, obviously. But, you know, USB is data. There's a lot of data that can go through there. And we had on the show just a couple of weeks ago, remember, the charger that, you know, was a key logger that just looked like a charger.
I'll do one better. We did run a story on Twiat a few months back. There was a study, I think it was in Virginia. They scattered a bunch of USB drives over a university campus to see if people would actually plug them in. And what they found out was that people were plugging them in, but they were plugging them into school computers. So it was like, well, this is probably bad, so I'll use someone else's computer to figure out exactly what's on it. So that's one part. The other part is, again, this came from DEF CON a few years back. We found it looked like a hotel. Have you ever been in a hotel where they give you like a Bluetooth speaker so that you can pair your phone to it so you can listen to music in your room? We found one that had been modified. It actually had a logger on the inside. So when it connected, it actually started downloading everything it could get off your phone. And then you could go back in later on and pull the memory unit out of it. And then you have all that person's information. So again, it's this idea of, yeah, it's a nice convenience, but unless I'm bringing it with me, I'm not connecting to it.
Right.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. And this whole discussion has also, I never thought before, you know, we're talking about data being downloaded to your rental car. But of course, people trust their own cars. And I assume you let your own car connect to your phone. No, Padre? No, you don't, because you already realized what I just realized, and that is, if your car gets stolen, not only have you lost your car, but you've lost your data, because there it is connected to your car.
And it's not only that, it's I don't trust Bluetooth. Bluetooth is not a secure communications protocol. So if I have it on and I forget to turn it off, I'm now walking around with a beacon in my pocket that someone could potentially connect to and start doing bad things. It's just... The whole idea is you have to cut your attack surface. And if I can cut my attack surface by keeping off a service that I barely use and I really don't trust, I will prefer to do that over the alternative.
Wow. Do the new Apple headphones connect via Bluetooth?
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
And there is no analog, so that's the only way to connect it.
Yes. All right. That's a discussion for another day. Let us move on. We promised you drones, and we're going to get to drones. I think we're going to make don't trust Bluetooth our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional and like to listen to our show for professional credit in your field. We put a couple of phrases in case you have to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. We'll do another one later on. Our first one is don't trust Bluetooth. So that is now our official first passphrase for the show. And if you need more information about this, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our show page there, and you will find more information about this. We also would like to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase or software installation. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. If you're a small business, you know that you're struggling with that all the time. And this is just a great way to make sure that folks understand that you're not unprofessional just because you're small. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS or text messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month. You have a 30-day money-back guarantee as well, so no harm, no foul here. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grasshopper, for making us more professional and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's take to the skies and talk with Padre about many issues related to the new drone rules, counter drones, and other interesting developments. So, Padre, you're covering enterprise tech on your show, and there are many, many enterprises that are happy that the FAA has announced its new drone rules for commercial use. But the aftermath of this announcement has been fuzzy on a number of fronts. There are still practices that people have been engaged in and maybe continue to be engaged in that may be curtailed under the new rules. Complying with the rules is not easy. Passing the test is not easy. I'm wondering what your take is from the enterprise side of things on the FAA's recent announcement.
Right. As you correctly pointed out, there's been a lot of enterprises and small businesses that have been waiting for these, because the FAA did release their guidelines for consumers a while back. Really simple. Mm-hmm. Basically, what we have come to expect from responsible drone flying, keeping it under 400 feet AGL, above ground level, always being in direct line of sight. If it's over 150 grams, you actually have to get a registration from the FAA, which I have. And it has to be mm-hmm. on the drone in a way that doesn't require tools to remove it. In other words, if you crash it, there's a way to find out where you are and contact you about damages that you may have caused. Unfortunately, when they released those consumer guidelines, they had just promised commercial guidelines. And that meant that if you wanted to fly a commercial drone, in other words, fly it for profit, for example, if you're doing a video shoot or if you're doing mm-hmm. crop surveying or oil surveying, you needed a pilot's license. And that made absolutely no sense, because flying a plane is not like flying a drone remotely. The skill set is not comparable. Now they've got the new commercial drone guidelines, and they sound very much like the consumer guidelines. 400 AGL, you have to keep it in line of sight. So people are happy now that there is a process that they can apply to get a commercial drone permit. However, they're looking at the limitations that the FAA has placed on commercial flight. And they've essentially taken away some of the best use cases, especially that line of sight requirement, because it mm-hmm. means that I can't do something like what FLIR has been working on, where you send a drone up into a cornfield. It is a pre-programmed flight path, and it will just use an infrared camera to go around your property and find out what areas need water. Very efficient way to do farming. Well, with the current guidelines, the way that they are, that is not permitted under any circumstances. So there's this mm-hmm. sort of pushback now of, okay, you've given us a start. Thank you for having a permit process. Now we need to have a conversation about what you're actually going to allow. And unfortunately, I don't know if the FAA is ready to have that conversation.
Right. And I think their answer to that problem at this point is, well, we have an exemption process in place. So if you have some good and safe technology that you want to be engaged in with your drone, that's not specifically authorized under the new rules, you'll have to come and get an exemption. So that's just, you know, yet another hoop to jump through.
And the problem is when everybody needs to get the exemption, then it's not an exemption. That should be the rule.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And we talked about last week on the show, I am trying to get the company that got one of the first line of sight exemptions that was in a sort of farming context. So they're granting them, but that line of sight thing is going to be a big deal. It's going to be a big deal for hobbyist drone users as well. As Emery knows, I went back at the beginning of August to the U.S. Nationals of Drone Racing in New York and got a firsthand view of how active that sport is, how up and coming it is. ESPN covered it live. And the people there, I remember at the time, the drone rules didn't come out till the end of the month. They were very excited about the consumer drone rules that had already come out and the new commercial ones that were coming out at the end of the month. But I don't think any of them really realized that the FAA's take on line of sight might put their entire sport out of business. Because as I read both the commercial and the consumer ones, there's at least an open question there. There's a really good piece at Motherboard for people more interested in that. That's in our discussion points. If you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, you'll find all our discussion points for the show. We also have a Flipboard magazine under my account at D Howell, where we're saving things related to the show. But what Motherboard says about drone racing now, and there's been this controversy about the FAA telling Forbes that if you're doing line of sight, you're going to need to comply with the commercial rules, actually, if you're not doing line of sight, if you're doing FPV through goggles. What Motherboard concluded was, for now, if you want to spend your time drone racing and be 100% cool with the FAA, you'll not only have to get a remote pilot certification, you'll also have to submit to a federal government background check. Even getting a certification and flying under Part 107, that's the commercial rules, is not necessarily a great idea for hobbyists, because anyone who flies under Part 107 must follow the more restrictive commercial regulations or Such restrictions on hobby flying are something that Congress specifically sought to prevent when it originally instructed the FAA to create drone regulations. So we've got something of a mess on the regulatory front. And I would just encourage you, you know, if you are someone who takes your drone flying very seriously, whether it's for commercial purposes or hobby purposes that, you know, is more than just a, well, for any hobby purposes, I'm going to tell you, because the FAA has shown that it will fine people. And if you just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, you may find yourself the poster child of that. But particularly if you're into racing, definitely consult with your racing body and get their best advice. The Association of Model Aircraft folks, it's not a trade organization, but sort of an oversight organization for hobby drone folks, has said one thing, the FAA has said another. So it's kind of a mess right now. I wanted to talk with you, Padre, about counter drone measures, either things that send an electromagnetic pulse or electric fences, things that might be more legal than Jennifer Youngman shooting your drone out of the sky. Have you been paying attention to the technology on the counter drone front?
Absolutely. Now, there's been a couple of companies that have really pushed for it. DJI, because mm-hmm. they are a multi-billion dollar business, understands that if they don't at least look to be including some sorts of technology that can keep drones out of airspace that they shouldn't be in, that they could potentially be locked out of certain very lucrative markets. So they have equipped their NASA controllers with firmware that, because they're all GPS enabled, they're also GPS aware. And so if you try to fly a drone, a DJI drone, over the White House lawn, it will not let you do it. There's an electronic wall. The drone will go mm-hmm. return to sender. That's mm-hmm. one thing. Unfortunately, if you're trying to legislate a solution like that, it won't work, because I can build a flight controller out of a $3 Arduino. And that's mm-hmm. that has always been the root of the problem here whenever you've talked about the legislation of drones, which is, how do you legislate something where the components are found everywhere? I can make drones out of my smartphone. I can make drones out of components I buy at Radio Shack, if you can still find a Radio Shack. I can buy the components for under $100 to make a drone that could carry up to, you know, 3, 4, 5 pounds of cargo. And so a lot of this has been good faith motions on the part of corporations that are building these drones. When we start talking about anti-drone technology, as you mentioned, there's been a couple of things that have come to mind. There are the electronic countermeasures, which do work. If you jam the control channel, a pilot will no longer have control, and either it will fall out of the sky or it will kick back into its pre-programmed return to home feature. The other way to do it is a physical restriction of the drone. And we've seen a couple of companies that have designed either lasers or physical projectiles that can target drones coming into restricted airspace, like, for example, a prison. In fact, there's just two that were deployed down the road here in California that knocked drones out of the sky that were trying to deliver contraband into the yard. So mm-hmm. it's a market. It is a new market, but it's now questionable, because it's actually illegal to throw up as much electromagnetic interference as you would need to knock out the control channel of a drone. And firing firearms into the sky is never a good idea, no matter what you're trying to do. Does that market exist? Yes. Do there need to be rules put on that market? Probably more than on the actual drone market itself.
Yeah. Neither you nor I, or nor Emery, attended InterDrone in Las Vegas, but I was following Brendan Schulman, who is a lawyer with DJI, who was there attending, and he spoke, et cetera. But he was live tweeting some of the sessions. And one of the things he mentioned was that FAA Administrator Huerta had the following quote: federal law prohibits disabling or destroying aircraft, and drones are aircraft. Yes, the drone countermeasure market is going to have to bear in mind that the FAA is going to provide drone owners and operators with some protection over these aircraft. I wonder what the FAA would think, not just of electronic pulses and accurate rifle shots, but possibly spears. We had some wonderful footage. Here we go. Boom.
That's a really good shot, by the way. I mean, kudos to that person. That's yes. Skill.
That was skill. That was a drone flying over a Middle Ages festival in Russia that where someone decided to take down the drone with a spear. So you never know what might come at your drone.
I do want to get some clarification here, though, because that tweet that you quoted from Brendan Schulman with the FAA administrator saying drones are aircraft, that's actually a policy shift because they have been resisting for the longest time to classify drones as aircraft. They already have enough trouble dealing with aircraft. Now you add millions upon millions, tens, hundreds of millions of devices that can be classified as aircraft, and the FAA's scope of responsibility grows exponentially. So I want to know if that was hyperbole, or is he actually saying drones can now be considered aircraft and are therefore required to do everything aircraft do and have all the same protections that aircraft have? Because I doubt that's what he's saying. I really, really do.
I don't know. We weren't at InterDrone, and we'll have to see if someone follows up on that and asks Commissioner or Administrator Huerta. And I have to correct myself, too. I said that AMA, in the acronym soup of things, stood for Model Aircraft Association. It doesn't. It is the Academy of Model Aeronautics.
Of which I am a proud member.
Good, good.
I've been for the last 40 years, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
40 years.
It's a bit like the second year of its existence, I became a member because I was flying model aircraft. The funny thing is, the model airplanes I used to fly way more dangerous than the drones I fly today.
Yeah.
Way scarier and way harder to control. I mean, if I let go of my controls, my drone will still stay in the air. If I let go of the controls of the B-17 bomber that I had made, the nice little small scale, I could crash through the top of a house. So go figure.
Well, one final drone topic to hit along those lines, of safety and the way technology has proceeded, is we have a story in our rundown called "Once Drones Get Artificial Intelligence, They'll Rule the World." And people do a lot of hand-wringing about self-driving cars and things. And eventually we will get to the point of self-flying drones, but this is one of those things where the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. A lot of drone technology today is already, you'd have to call it AI-driven. You'll have to tell us, Padre, about the unique drone that you've flown recently and various others, but having just had some cursory exposure to a DJI Phantom a couple of weeks ago, its anti-collision mechanism, I think you'd have to call some form of AI, its ability to, as you mentioned, Padre, come home if it gets itself into trouble, is an AI kind of feature. So what do you think about more and more automation making its way into drone technologies?
I think it will make it safer because I like to fly raw drones. There's not a lot of intelligence on the ones that I build. A, because that makes it very expensive. But B, I kind of like being able to pilot it. The drones that you would buy from, say, 3DR or DJI or Unique or any of the big ones, they can be flown kind of manually, but the intelligence is never really designed to be turned off completely. And that's for a certain type of flyer. I'm not that kind of flyer.
Part 107, like the current rules would definitely not allow for the kind of AI, totally hands-off driven drone that is being proposed here.
Right. Like, for example, 3DR, they're solo. It's got this beautiful feature. They call it line. And it works like a camera on a line. So you could go into a stadium and you establish a line based on GPS coordinates, and it will just fly back and forth. And you can just control the camera like you would with one of those really expensive cameras that like fly down a football field. Okay, those do work, and they're getting much more smart. And, for example, the Unique drone that I saw at IFA, it's way better than the Lily drone that we paid for 2 years ago. That it's really good at collision avoidance, but like the DJI drone, it can recognize faces. So once you lock it onto a face, it will try to follow that face no matter where you are. And see, that's it right there. That's how small it is. And those propellers actually fold up. So you can carry this thing in a backpack, and then it just deploys when you need it. Now, that's all doable because they've built enough smarts into the drone where it knows, okay, stay away from walls, stay away from people, stay away from trees. But we're in the very nascent stage of this. This is like where self-driving cars were 2 years ago, where they're going to start detecting all these anomalous situations where the drone doesn't know what to do. And unfortunately, unlike a car, which can just stop, a drone can't really do anything. I mean, if it detects an error, either it drops out of the sky or it potentially runs into something. The learning curve on this is much higher.
Is that one the one you can throw into the air and it'll just start flying?
Yes.
Yes.
Very Which cool. I think that's how everyone wants to do that whole, here you go, selfie. And
Did you try that out?
They wouldn't let us turn it on inside.
Too bad.
Well, yeah, that's, by the way, not to bring it back to the boring rules discussion, but one of the rules that I thought was surprising that is not getting as much talk is that, I mean, as I read them, small unmanned aircraft may not operate over any persons not directly participating in the operation. Makes sense. But also not under a covered structure and not inside a covered stationary vehicle. So your idea of, you know, flying a drone, making a drone video inside of a warehouse or inside of a stadium seems out. I mean, there are also rules that say that, you know, daylight only operations. So daylight or civil twilight, which is the 30 minutes before and after nightfall in morning. I mean, that means that, you know, if we're talking about counter drone measures of having drones watching your property to make sure that other drones aren't flying into it, well, those drones can't fly at night to do that. I mean, there's just, I have to say the regulations here seem to be encouraging a very, very, very particular specific kind of commercial drone activity that seems really limited to basically going out to a property, taking your drone out, flying it and using it as a camera on with wings, you know, and outside of that, it's very limited. You know, the problem with the disagreement with the AMA and the FAA, I think the reading of the FAA's rule is pretty clear that their intention is to say that no FPV flying or first person viewing flying is just not allowed unless you're also getting a pilot's license.
By the way, this
Why
right here,
getting that,
this
insane.
Is illegal. You cannot in the United States. You cannot fly a drone at the beach because a beach is a federal park.
Wow! Yeah.
So these people should be arrested.
Federal parks are off limits under both the consumer hobbyist rules and the commercial rules.
You can get a commercial. So if you have the commercial license, you can get a permit to take photos in that area, but you cannot do it as a consumer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and do you know? I think I saw in fact, the fact sheet that we're going to mention to you in just a moment as one of our resources here, some guidance from the FAA, or at least a summary trying to help you understand part 107. I think I saw that there may be a divergence from the hobbyist requirements, because under the hobbyist requirements, I remember I was reading that if you're within 5 miles of an airport, you're actually supposed to pick up the phone and tell them when you're going to start flying your drone.
All right, San Diego, you are out. All of San Diego. Sorry.
Right.
No drones here.
Orange County too, a large part of LA. Yes. I mean, airports are in central areas. And one thing I know is that none of these airports wants to be fielding phone calls from every local drone owner saying, okay, here I go. Do you know what the status is of that, Padre? Because I think maybe in the commercial rules, you're exempted from needing to do that.
No, I mean, those rules are hard set. So if you're within 5 miles of an airport, you absolutely have to call the tower.
You have to call them.
And nobody will take your call. So the rule is, don't fly within 5 miles of an airport.
So I guess that does effectively rule out any San Diego drone company.
Most of San Jose, most of San Francisco, all of Oakland.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, all right. So you're an experienced pilot. How reasonable do you think that is?
I err on the side of caution. So, and I've seen people do really stupid things with drones. In fact, flying back from Germany, I was in Amsterdam for a while, and at Schiphol, at the airport, Unique is in the airport. They have a store in the airport that's very popular. But as you go through all the moving walkways, they have these the digital signage, and they always put on there's a video of someone flying really, really poorly outside near the beacon. This was a YouTube video, and they just remind people, please don't do this. I'd like to say that people will do the smart thing, but unfortunately, YouTube has proved that wrong. People will do stupid things. There was actually one video of a drone operator watching from the air an A380 on rollout. And it's like,
oh my God,
what made you think that was a good idea? That's horrific. I mean, you're putting so many people at danger. And so I'm willing to curtail a little bit of my own personal freedom to stop the really stupid people.
Yeah. Right.
What do you think about the...
I'm going to drop our second MCLE passphrase into the show, and it is airport won't take my call. Go ahead, Emery.
Well, I was going to say, what do you think of the requirement barring of flying inside? I guess my thought is that, a lot of the drones that are flying inside are probably going to be under 155 grams, but not all of them, right? I would imagine that, I'm just thinking, I want my drone that can, fly the remote controller from the corner to my hand or, go pick up the newspaper, just like that article was, talking about. But as I read the rules, at least, they say that you can't fly it underneath a covered building.
And then that begs the question, are I not a sovereign in my own house? So if I want to fly a drone, if I want to fly a 400-pound drone in my house, do you have a right to come in and stop me?
I can definitely, bring my, motorcycle into the garage and, these are hugely dangerous pieces of equipment. I don't know. Very interesting.
Yes. All right. Well, I think the big takeaway from this conversation is that the three of us and many others who have paid attention to these rules can sit and talk about what they mean and what their implications are. But if you're a business, you had better darn well pay attention to them, because I think that you're going to be in the sights, no pun intended, probably more than hobbyists are. It's my guess that these rules are going to be out there and lost on certainly most of the hobbyists, many of the businesses, and we're going to have some interesting stories coming down the pipe of people who just weren't aware of what the rules were and did something stupid, like you pointed out, Padre. Here's something you might see at Halloween. This is one of our resources of the week, for letting you know that this would be something that if you did follow all the rules, maybe you could get away with. Or maybe you should start getting your counter ghouls ready. We have someone right down the street from us that does something like this every year and flies a ghoul dressed up drone down the street for Halloween. As Emery was pointing out before the show, aside from various registration and labeling and other requirements, they better pay attention to the no flying at night requirement for Halloween. So we thought you'd get a kick out of that. That's something that was featured at Popular Mechanics.
A few things about that, bro. That's definitely over 150 grams, so that does have to be registered. So they must have a visible sticker or something that lists their registration number. Secondly, something like
no
that.
No costumes, then.
You have to fly it at night. You light that thing up and you fly it at night. So already it's taking some of the childish joy out of Halloween.
Yes. Downer FAA. And then I mentioned our other resource of the week is the Drone Law Fact Sheet from the FAA. It is a summary of Part 107 and gives you sort of the bullet points and more things you can go explore when you're scratching your head and going, well, what does that mean exactly? So if you are at all flying drones, either I encourage you, even if you're just a hobbyist, to be aware of what these new commercial requirements are, because part of what you're doing as a hobbyist may fall within them and you just never know. And certainly if you're planning a commercial endeavor around drones, at least start here. We featured another site that is a joint effort of the Academy of Model Aeronautics. Do I have that right now?
Yes.
That you're a member of? Yes. Mm-hmm. Academy of Model Aeronautics and the FAA. And that is Know Before You Fly. KnowBeforeYouFly.org has tons and tons of information on
is
both
K-N-O
fronts.
K-N-O or N-O? Like, no, you cannot go before you fly.
Yes, well, it depends on your perspective, I'm sure. But if you want to start that certification process, et cetera, they have quick links to how to do that and who should be doing it, et cetera, et cetera. Our animal selfie of the week, we have two of them for you. So let's get to those. Our first one is our first animal selfie of the week. That is not an animal, but I'm featuring it here because of the many discussions we've had, including just in last week's show, about personhood and how that kind of an analysis factors into what sort of an entity or being can have and assert legal rights. And the country of New Zealand has taken a step to designate one of its parks, the Te Uruwara Park, and a river within that park as a legal person, much like a corporation here in the United States would be. So it can, this was done, as you can see if you're watching our video, in the context dispute as to who owns the park, what the outcome of that dispute was. But the country decided that it would be a good idea for the park and its river to have personhood in the context of that dispute. So the broader ramifications of this is other countries have done similar things with natural resources. I believe Ecuador was the first one. So keep an eye on this as far as the kinds of rights that animals may be granted in certain parts of the world, the rights of nature principle, as you just saw there on her on their video. So something to keep an eye on. And our other animal selfie of the week to be featured this week are those taken by Alan Dixon. He is in New Zealand, coincidentally enough, and he has an Instagram page. He is a taker primarily of animal selfies that feature himself in the picture where he is the photographer, whether with a selfie stick or just by operating the camera himself. So in most of the instances of his pictures, I think we would not have the legal personhood discussion, and PETA might not want to get involved to see whether some of the llamas, quokkas, and adorable baby goats that he is photographing have their own rights in those photos. Except, of course, you know, if the legal personhood standard is to go that far, perhaps they might have some claim over their the unauthorized use of their likeness. So anything to add here, Emery?
I am just so floored by the Nature's a Person article. I don't think that I've donated enough like mental cycles to really have a good idea of how I feel about it, but it feels ridiculous to me. It sounds like, you know, are we going to have like all right, so it's a person, whatever that means. How do you judge that person's intent or wishes, or like who represents that person? Does that like how does that person say no? I'm all for environmental justice. You know, I think that the obviously the right of the Maori to, you know, control their forest would have been, you know, why don't we just say that the first people actually are the people that can control the forest or the you know, what happens to the park, instead of saying that this park is now a person and that somehow solves a problem. It doesn't.
So it's,
I don't really
see
how this is.
It's not just
forward.
That nature is a person.
The reason I bring it up is,
It's that nature is a minor. So nature is a minor who has legal dependence upon someone who is responsible for its well-being. I understand what they're going for, but it seems a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
It does, and it also seems like the same kind of argument that would be made ultimately about some super intelligent artificial intelligence. So I bring it up just to have you guys watch that space, because it's an interesting legal concept that will mm-hmm. be ported over to other areas probably. So that is the end of this episode of This Week in Law. It's been super fun to have Padre back on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me back. Anytime. I'm still a little bit exhausted, but when you offered Tool, I said I have to do this, especially if we're going to talk about drones.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll come back and do more of that. I think that the dust kind of has to settle on the new rules, and a few people have to be made an example of, and then we'll probably have more to talk about along those lines going forward. So we'll look forward to that. We'll look forward to many future great episodes of Know How and Twyatt. Thanks to you. Anything else that you want to let us know about before we wrap up the show?
Just one thing, and that is if you are interested in perhaps thumbing your nose at the FAA, Know How will be doing a few episodes on building under 150 gram drone aircraft. So stop on by. Again, that's twit.tv/KH, and we'll show you how you can make a drone that is completely legal and yet requires no registration whatsoever.
Right. But even for something that's not within the weight requirement, Padre, wouldn't you still have to follow some of the recreational rules?
Oh, absolutely. Like
where you can fly and who you can fly over and all that.
Right.
But you don't have to register it.
Don't fly over anybody. Don't fly it at night, and fly it within line of sight. That's basically
don't fly over roads. Yeah. Call your airport.
Yeah. Don't invest in FPV goggles right now.
Yeah. Don't spend a lot of money in FPV goggles because we don't know if we can actually use them.
Yeah, that's
a shame. That's super cool.
Yeah, they are. All right, Emery, thank you so much for joining us again. Glad you're back in San Diego. Anything else you want to let us know before we sign off today?
No, I want to thank Padre for joining us and appreciate his expertise in drones. This has been a great show.
Yeah, it sure has. Thank you both so much. And thank you all for joining us on this episode of This Week in Law. We record the show every Friday afternoon. Starting in morning on the West Coast here. We start at 11 p.m. 1800 UTC, 11 Pacific time. That's when you can join us live and follow along as we do the show. Jump into IRC with us. Have a ball. If you can't or won't or simply don't have the time on Fridays to join us when we record live, don't worry about that. Head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there for you, so you can enjoy them at your leisure, including digging back into the archive and watching our Yo Quiero Taco drone show. We didn't get around to talking on the show today, but Padre, did you see the 3D printed drone that could deliver a pizza?
Indeed. But I'm more interested in the one that can deliver burritos, because I could really go for one right now.
Mm. Yes, yes. Drones and food delivery definitely on the horizon. But that's a toughie under the new rules. So we're going to see some tension around that too. So what else should you do? You should follow us or get in touch with us via Twitter or other social media. I'm Dee Howell there. Emery is Emery Roan there. Padre, of course, is Padre SJ there. Great place to let us know what's on your mind, what you thought of the show, what you'd like to see us cover on future shows. Mike Keyes will be back with us next week. He was a little busy this week, so we gave him a pass, but we'll rope him back in soon enough. You can get in touch with my co-host Mike, who's not here, or Emery, or me by email as well. We are respectively Mike@twit.tv, Emery@twit.tv, and Denise@twit.tv. So let us know what's on your minds in that channel, or find us on Facebook or Google+. The show has pages in both those venues. So
seriously, it's really great hearing from listeners. Whether you guys are, giving us advice or criticism or show topics, please reach out to us. It's always good to hear from you.
It really, really is. And we'd love to know you're out there. We love to know what you think. And we literally couldn't do the show without all the great suggestions that you're constantly sending our way. So please do keep them coming. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.